Hi. So this is a lecture on Kwame Ture and Charles Hamilton's Black Power, the Politics of Liberation. I'll mostly refer to Ture throughout because I know about him. I don't know much about Charles Hamilton. As far as I know, he took part in this book and became a professor. But Kwame Ture is, you know, well known as a sort of, a pan-African global revolutionary. This is the guy previously known as Stokely Carmichael. He was a central figure in SNCC, the Southern National Coordinating Committee. It was originally the Southern Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. They changed the name because they no longer necessarily affirmed the tactic. And then he gets pushed out of the United States by COINTELPRO. But had already developed an interest in Africa and in pan-African liberation work. The basic idea here is that in order for oppressed peoples in the global north, especially black people, to achieve any kind of liberation, they need to work together with oppressed peoples in the so-called third world, and specifically African American people, ought to be looking to the circumstance of Africa, where they can find huge masses of people in circumstances relatively similar to theirs, as far as Ture is concerned, entirely similar to theirs, because both, according to him and Hamilton, are circumstances of colonization. So this is the picture that is being drawn here, but I give it to you in order to start thinking about the conditions of black people in the United States in particular, but also I think these models can be generalized, so we can talk about historically oppressed groups in the United States. Definitely Native American people constitute a colony in the United States, but then Latinx people. And I think there's a model for organizing here which is expandable to just about any and every group that can identify itself as such. That's what I want to provide here. Now, the text itself is based around, and especially the section that I gave you, is based around the notion of white power to begin with, and then the counter notion of black power. And so the way that I'll lay this stuff out is by, according to that same pattern, by describing a problem, which in every case could be described as a problem of white power, and which also can be described as a variety or a dimension of colonization. And then I'll follow that up with a counter power, which could be called in each case black power, and which in maybe more familiar language today we could call, you know, decolonial strategy. So here's the first claim, and this is a claim that was very influential in the 1960s, which emerged out of people like Frantz Fanon and his book, especially The Wretched of the Earth, but which was contested also, especially, say, at the beginning of the 1970s by people like James Boggs and Grace Lee Boggs. And the position is that black people in the United States constitute a colony, that by looking at colonial relations elsewhere, the circumstance of black folks in the U.S., and as I said, by extension, maybe other groups as well, can be understood as fundamentally colonial. Now, in the text I give you, this, let me back up. It's not just that the situation of black people in America, Native American people in America, and so on, result from colonization. Of course it does. Clearly it does. And racial identity, racialization, I think is the correct term, that also stems from colonization. This is important to recognize. Race is not simply an objective phenomenon in the world. It's something that is imposed by conquerors in order to differentiate and divide a conquered population. That differentiation between so-called racial types then takes a legal form. It's related to property structure. It's related to rights and behavior, and therefore it operates in placing people in positions, certain positions, within the division of labor, And so it becomes realized. Racialization starts with colonization, and through colonial practice, race comes into reality. But this is not the only reason that Touré thinks he can refer to African-American people as being in a colonial situation. He thinks there are formal similarities, identical formal circumstances, if we are comparing, say, African people in Africa under British and French rule, mainly, or whether we're considering people of African descent in the United States. There are formal similarities to their circumstance, and this is what he's going to try to describe. And then on the basis of this description, he's going to, or they are going to, attempt to offer some solutions. So they'll say there are, I count four, they say, they list off three dimensions of colonization going on probably in general and going on specifically in the United States. Social colonization, political colonization, educational colonization. What? Social colonization, political colonization, economic colonization, and maybe we could add, although they don't distinguish this, they definitely talk about it at length, what I would call ideological domination. Now, just one passing note before I go on to each one of these in turn. When we talk about colonization, they also specify, and I'm sure you found this because this is in the first couple of pages, they specify that you could use another term if you wanted for the colonization of black folks in the U.S., and that term would be institutional racism. So they distinguish between individual racism, which I think they think rightly is often the only thing acknowledged, and institutional racism. Individual racism is what we usually think of as racist. This is where some individuals have some nasty ideas about some other individuals based on stereotypes about their race and so on, and they carry out violent acts of one sort or another against those people. That's racism, individual racism. And that exists, and it's ugly, and it's easy to point out. And generally, Touré and Hamilton point out, generally, it's absent from the majority of Americans in their overt behaviors anyway, and especially from the upper classes who are too well-educated and too refined and too careful in their behavior to let this sort of thing slip out in public. But this is not the only kind of racism. There's another kind which is much more important, and that is the one that is pervasive through American society. This they call institutional racism. Institutional racism, in the text that I give you, they don't actually go straight for a definition except to identify it with colonization. And that is what they're going to describe it at length. But if I were to attempt here to define it, I would say that institutional racism is the structuring and then targeting of particular groups of people in racial categories such that certain policies affect them differently than other people are affected. So if you see patterns of segregation in Los Angeles in terms of housing, that is institutional racism. When you see the extremely disproportionate imprisonment of black and brown people compared to white people in the United States, that is institutional racism. When you see large unemployment rates for specific black and brown populations, much higher than those of white populations, that is institutional racism. When you see different educational levels or educational opportunities for black people and brown people in the United States versus white people, that is institutional racism. And they say they understand institutional racism to be basically the same thing as colonialism, or another way of describing basic colonial relationships. Okay, so they don't list, I mean, they list this one at the beginning, but they don't spend a lot of time on it, but I think it fits in here. So let me first talk about what they call social colonialism. So how does that operate? How does a colonial power, either, let's say, the British operating in Africa, or the white power structure in the United States operating upon black people, how does it operate socially? What is the social dimension of this colonization? Well, first of all, colonial practice requires the division of the people who will be dominated. They have to be pulled apart from one another. They have to be separated. One way in which this will happen, we'll come to in a moment, it's called indirect rule. You're going to select out some special people, make them feel good and cool about the white power structure, put them in positions of power over everyone else, and leverage your control over them to control everybody else. Dividing and weakening, definitely weakening the colonial population. And this is important, I think, for us to think about. One of the ways in which colonized populations historically have been weakened is through denial of education. Don't let them know where they're at. Don't give them the powers to analyze where they're at and to come up with plans of action. Religion operates here too. You want to give not just any old religion, but Christianity, and not even just Christianity in general, but a specific interpretation of Christianity, emphasizing the turning of the other cheek and so on. You want to make a passive population. You want to hide their heritage. A population which can draw upon a history of freedom and self-determination is more problematic from the perspective of a colonial controller than is a population that thinks it's always been down, it always should be down, it's never done anything good, it's never contributed anything to civilization. And these are the typical things that colonizers tell the colonized, right? And, you know, in every other way, you try to destroy that community. You don't want to destroy its capacity to work for you or to provide profit for you, but in every other way you want to destroy it, up to and including introduction of liquor, drugs, heroin. I mean, those introductions of those substances into these communities in the 1960s and 1970s can still be understood as an aspect of colonial practice, the purpose of which is to weaken those communities. And so I'll do this in each case. I think they offer a counterpoint. So what do you have to do to reverse these colonial practices, to rebuild what we'll call black power here? You have to unite the population, which has been previously and intentionally divided. You have to re-find and redistribute a history, a heritage, propaganda, if you like, about the identity of the people themselves. You have to show them that it is possible for them to define their own goals. They have to aim at group solidarity. They have to seek control. They have to create power bases. And I think that's an important and generalizable sort of thing there. What does it mean to create a power base? It means to control a space, control territory. It means to self-determine practices and to have practices that empower people. And it means to put communities together and hold them together. A community is a power base. Okay, here is the variety of colonialism I think they talk about most, although it may still be that the most important is economic. The one that they talk about most is political colonization. This is another aspect of white power. What does it mean that there exists a white power structure in the United States politically? It means that, generally speaking, white people make decisions that affect the bodies of black people. That's political colonization. You control the decision-making that affects a particular population from outside that population. Now, notice in the United States, at least eventually, African Americans do have political rights that are equal to whites, and yet this having of political rights in the absence of a restructuring of the society doesn't actually make them equal. They can still be colonized, even while they technically still have the same legal rights as everybody else, because there are these structural moves to control the decision-making practice which affects them, including, you know, simple things like voter redistricting, gerrymandering of voting districts, this sort of thing. Now, here's a more specific analysis of political colonialism, which I mentioned a minute ago, indirect rule. here is something that you can find all over the colonized world, all over the United States, all over the imperial world and the neoliberal world of today. I think this is still everywhere. This is indirect rule. So what is indirect rule? That's where you pick a small group of people and you co-opt them somehow. In the United States, you can talk about members of, say, black members of, say, the Democratic Party, either at the city level or the state level or the federal level, what Torrey and Hamilton call the black establishment. Those people, they stand up, they look like, you know, kind of the most successful instances of the African-American community. Like, look, they've succeeded. They get to hang out with white people. They have fancy ways of speaking. They have fancy clothes. They live with white people often. And yet the analysis here is that they're bought off. And what they're bought off to do is to provide a semblance of black self-determination for a population which is nevertheless, in truth, determined by white power. How does that operate? Well, it operates because those who indirectly rule actually follow the will of those who put them in charge. This is true about black leaders in the United States, and this is a very harsh attack upon such leaders. And it's true of national leaders across the colonized world, and especially in Africa, the one that Kwame Ture or Ture and Hamilton most often refer to as Kenya, where chiefs who previously had very little power but had some degree of social prestige were selected by the British power structure as the means by which to control the rest of the black population. So indirect rule. And Ture and Hamilton say this is all over the place. It's not just the prominent political figures. It's all the way down to school teachers and county agents and junior executives. These are people whose skills could serve the community, but because they have sold off their capacities, they have, in return for having, you know, some kind of middle class, semi-respectable position, some kind of security, they have sold off their activity. They have given their will over to the white power structure. Okay, so what do you do against that? Well, first of all, you have to question all these existing values and institutions. You have to ask whether those things came from the colonized community itself or from outside it, because so many ideas come from outside. You have to look for new and different forms of political structure and some kind of structure which affirms a dependable bottom-up control. And you got to broaden the base of political participation. You got to make politics a part of everyday life, even though most people in dominated circumstances have given up on politics. They see that it's fake and they don't think that it's for them. You have to make it for them again. Now, there's some specific comments here about the middle class, which I think are really important and which resonate with me because this is partly where I'm coming from. You know, I have some rooting in the working class where I grew up, but, you know, I had an educated dad and I moved around. I went to a fancy school. So I've been around these white liberals and I don't know. I can attest that Ture and Hamilton are right. So what's the problem with the middle class? The problem with the middle class, the white middle class, is that it mouths its preference for a free, competitive society while at the same time forcefully and even viciously denying to black people as a group the opportunity to compete. They want good government, but only for themselves, good schools, but only for themselves. So they say this class is the backbone of institutional racism in this country. Now, why bring up the middle class? Because this is 1968. This is a moment when these particular black activists or black leaders are reevaluating or criticizing the previous civil rights movement. And these, you know, Ture was central to that movement. He was involved in getting out the vote and all that. But he's now saying, look, the goal of integration, which is the goal of becoming a part of that middle class, is totally mistaken. Because the goals, the values, the life pattern of the white middle class is no good. It's entirely materialistic. It's not based on human dignity. So they want a different political strategy, which also means identifying and pursuing different political goals. They don't want to aim, first of all, at property. They do want to control territory, but they don't want to aim at property, first of all. They want to aim at dignity. Not money, but freedom are the things that they need to aim at and be really worried. They advise people to be very skeptical about the language and the goals that are announced and the sort of evaluations that are given from the perspective either of people who want to join that middle class or from that middle class themselves. White liberals who want to help you out, don't trust us. Don't trust them. Reject the goal of assimilation. And notice that that tone of voice that was used in the civil rights period, I think this is a really sharp, though harsh, critique. The tone of voice and the values that were espoused were oriented towards that white middle class. It didn't sound like working class black people talking. It was a speech and a movement, the definition of which was oriented towards this middle class. This whole thing about, you know, love and suffering and patience and progress. They say the white society devised the language, adopted the rules, and had the black community narcotized. So what do you do instead? You emphasize dignity, not the sanctity of property. And there's another comment here that I think deserves a moment, and that is that black visibility is not black power. You know, co-opting small portions of the black community and giving people token positions within businesses and within politics and so on, that makes black people visible. And I think we still live in an era where everybody is still demanding more visibility, more representation. We want there to be diverse representations in our advertising and so on. But if that's all that we've got, then the structures, which are the real problem, are not being addressed. So black visibility is not black power. What is black power? It's the capacity to determine at the political level, the economic level, the social level, and the ideological level for yourself, for black people to determine for themselves. And again, I think these models are expandable. They're generalizable. What Ture is saying for black people, you can say for Chicana people, you can say probably for women. In each one of these instances, what is important, what really grows power, is politically self-determination, economically self-sustaining or self-sustenance, socially self-composition and maintenance, self-definition, and ideologically, definitely, self-determination of identity, goals, and so on. This is about black power is about self-control for black people, self-determination, but not on any kind of representational level, not first of all on a representational level, first of all on a real, lived, practical basis. And then what else should take place politically? Black power has to involve self-defense, community self-defense. And that means that Ture and Hamilton are opposing themselves to people like King. They don't want to turn the other cheek. They're not interested. The way they put it, rampaging white mobs and white night riders must be made to understand that their days of free head whipping are over. Black people should and must fight back. And then also, a nonviolent approach to civil rights is an approach black people cannot afford and a luxury white people do not deserve. Okay. And then next, economic colonization. They say a bit less about this, and I gave you a bit less here because it gets into a lot of statistics, which are not particularly up to date. This may still be the most important thing for them, economic self-determination. And this is a reason that the Black Power movement has, you know, connections with Marxist and communist thought. Economic self-determination means the seizure of the means of production, right? So the claim is that black people, and they're talking about the ghetto, right? So poor, isolated, segregated black and brown communities, things involving like food deserts, like we talk about. Places like this constitute economic colonies within the larger nation. What does that mean? It means that they are tapped for their resources, but they are given no benefits in return. They don't have power over what they do, but their resources are utilized to empower somebody else, namely white America. What resources? Now, they pause here and they're like, now you might not believe us because clearly in Africa, when the British are in Kenya, they don't just want Kenyan labor, they also want Kenyan resources, Kenyan oil, Kenyan diamonds. But he says this is sort of a trivial distinction. The only thing that black and brown poor people in America have to offer, have to exploit, is their labor. And that is the fundamental thing that is being taken out of the community. But not only that, it's also whatever loose pocket change they've got, right? So the tendency is to dehumanize people in the ghetto and produce dependency on their part. They can't live, they're super proletarianized. They can't live unless they work for white people. And they work cheap, and they're forced to work cheap. But then when they come back, they have to deal with these parasitic businesses, which are owned by people outside of the community, but which make a profit off of black people within the community. This explains, by the way, why it is not irrational for rebellious black people in the ghetto to destroy destroy businesses in their own community, because they're not their own businesses. And they go through a good long list of the ways in which this takes place. So how do you fight back? Again, the emphasis is on the construction of groups. You can't do it individually. If you think of your struggle as just individual, you're just trying to get ahead, you're trying to succeed, you have sacrificed your community. You have left that economic colony intact. And the best thing that you're going to become is what they'll call, you know, a token, what Malcolm X will call an Uncle Tom, right? That the only way to empower the ghetto community is to form it into a whole, because as they say, they're not oppressed as individuals only or primarily, they're oppressed as a group. And then more specifically, there's a sort of ideological dimension here. They have to reject the Protestant work ethic and reject this whole model of achievement and success. You got to get rid of it. Here's a couple of quotations. The goal is not to take black children out of the black community and expose them to white middle-class values. The goal is to build and strengthen the black community. And another one. What must be abolished is not the black community, but the dependent colonial status that has been inflicted upon it. Okay, and then lastly, they don't talk separately about what I would call ideological colonization, but they do talk at length about the establishment of identities and goals and beliefs, and I would call those things ideological. So, I mean, another way to look at this is that insofar as black people, brown people, Native American people, and we could probably expand this list in the United States, are under the domination of the white power structure, this also means that they are mentally controlled. Ideology is a psychological control over minds. And this includes especially the imposition of definitions and the imposition of a particular history, which are selected by, imposed by, and selected for and imposed for the empowerment of the white establishment. So you're going to tell African-American people that they're lazy and backwards, and you're going to tell Native American people that they're savages, and you're going to tell both of them that they have nothing to do with civilization, that they're barbaric, that they never contributed anything to progress. They didn't have anything to do with the amazing technological and economic and so on breakthroughs of Europe. And you're going to give them this whole rap about how great Europe is and how awesome its history has been, and even make it seem like the enslavement of Africans was like maybe an unpleasant little passage, but really for everybody's good, because here these black folks are in the greatest country in the world. You're going to impose these stories upon this population. And maybe you're going to support the idea of, you know, at the best, if you're a liberal, the idea of integration. And what's the response to this? What is counter ideology? You have to question the values, the beliefs, the institutions that are imposed upon you. You have to reclaim and reinvent your identity and your history. You cannot accept those definitions which are given to you because they are put there in order to keep you in your subservient position. Instead, you got to figure out how to define yourself in a way that empowers you, to define your community in a way that empowers it. And this empowerment that I'm talking about, this can't just be some fluffy, making you feel good about yourself kind of stuff. Empowerment has to have a real material dimension. So we're talking about decolonization. How do we decolonize with colonies that are in the mother country, which is a bad way to put it, in the dominating country, by liberating capacity to define, but more specifically by liberating schools, by liberating neighborhoods, by liberating territory, by liberating means of production. And to put it even more harshly, I don't mean liberate, I mean take over. And this is a clear and explicit goal of Black Power: control over schools, community control over schools, community control over policing, and by that means, partially, community control over its own territory, community control over its identity, community control over its history, especially as that is inscribed and reinscribed through schooling. All of these things are material buildings of power, not just some fluffy, like, you know, you should feel empowered feeling thing. Okay, now why does all this stuff matter beyond 1968 and maybe beyond the specific circumstance of African American people? Well, because I think that the circumstance that is described here, this circumstance where a certain population is disempowered, is lied to, is robbed of its identity and its history, which is set up to be exploited politically, economically, for profit, that circumstance exists for many more people. The basic external determination of pattern of life exists for many, many more people than just African American people. So the way I see it, the notion of Black Power can be seen as a gift to other communities in struggle. And definitely, if you look at like Ture and Malcolm X together, you can see them as offering a basic model for a general form of organization based on community building, community self-defense, local takeovers, local self-determination. So to whom else does this apply? Clearly, it applies to Mexican people, Central American people in the United States. It applies to women who have their identity and their circumstances dictated from without. It applies to prison populations, which are sometimes impossible to distinguish from enslaved populations, undocumented populations. Working class population, maybe in general, is in a circumstance where it is told what it's supposed to strive for, supposed to, you know, work hard and then succeed. It is told who it is, or you're either a hard worker or you're a lazy good for nothing. It lives in a circumstance where everything that all the decisions that are made for it are made by somebody outside of its circumstance. The working class people don't decide what's going to happen with their schools or with their street. Somebody else does. Economically determined from outside. This is the nature of neoliberalism. So, and if we were to get more specific, this is the situation of adjuncts, of lecturers in the Cal States. Our circumstances are dictated from outside of us. Who we are and who we are supposed to be is dictated from outside of us. It's probably true for students that y'all are told what it means to be a good student. Y'all are told what makes a good student and a bad student, and you would be better off if you took those definitions into your own hands, figured out what was your own interest, and tried to build the capacity to operate toward that interest. Social organization, political decisions, economic reality, ideological reality need to be controlled by the people who are affected by it. That's the position. And so the general strategy is we need to unify ourselves. We need to root ourselves in places and control those places. We need to insist on making choices that affect us for ourselves. We need to economically move away from dependency and figure out how to locally control facilities and resources. Now, by the way, lest this all sound utopian and impossible, just let me point out that that idea of rooting yourself in a territory, controlling space, developing a capacity for self-defense, and using that capacity for self-defense to extend to control over your political process. Because if you don't control the process of decision-making, you can't defend yourself ever. That really exists in Rojava right now, in northern Syria. The Kurdish independence movement there, the Democratic Confederalist Society, is such a society. And economically, you know, that idea of taking over resources, taking over space, developing the capacity to grow food, taking over means of production so that tools and machinery that are necessary for, say, like building projects and other business enterprises are available for the whole community, that's there in Jackson, Mississippi, in Cooperation Jackson. So these things are not impossible. They're real. And I think that they offer us all, or at least all of us who care to be determined by ourselves and who prefer not to dominate others, there's a model here that we can all take, at least into our thinking, as a model of counterpower.